All right. We are in the message series of Advent. And Advent is looking at, as we talked about before, everyone's like, it's Christmas. We're excited because Jesus is coming. And the question is, wait, why are we excited again? Right? Sometimes it can be the thing where you go to the parade because everyone else is there. But you're like, well, I thought this was fireworks. Like, what's going on here? This is something exciting. I get way more excited about fireworks than parades. So we want to uncover, what is it about Jesus that's so exciting? What is it about the life and ministry of Jesus, the birth of Jesus, that is such a big deal? And so to have that conversation, we've been looking at different aspects of who Jesus is. One, we've looked at the what was foretold about him, the prophecy, and we find a lot of that in this book, Isaiah, and we've talked about some of what's in Isaiah. And then we look at a story from the life of Jesus, how he actually demonstrated this thing. So we talked about this so far in grace last week, and we talked about it in justice the week before, these gifts of justice and grace to his people. And this morning, we're going to be talking about hope. And one of the things that gets me thinking about hope, have you ever been around a young child when they drop their ice cream cone? Like, I feel like this is like, it's required toddlerhood. Like, you have to drop your ice cream cone at some point. If you've ever been around a toddler that drops their ice cream cone, it's the most devastating moment. Like, you don't want to be there. It's like their world ends. Like, everything from that point forward is forever shaded with your ice cream cone fell on the ground. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's just this total and complete body shutdown. It's like, oh, there goes my knees, down. And then it's tears and crying, and sometimes they're on the floor. It's like, and you're running to the counter, like, we'll take five more ice cream cones. Just ensure, we just want to ensure that we're safe, right? And I've thought a bit about that. When you're around a child, you're like, why is it so dramatic? Why is it so dramatic? If you're 2.5 years old, how much of your life and experience so far do you even remember? It's not a full 2.5 years, right? We can agree on that. Like, maybe those very early moments are probably blocked out. Like, they're not a part of that. So they have this very small window that they're aware and they remember. And do you want to know where the ice cream cone dropping ranks on the devastation scale? Like, really high. That might legitimately be a top 10 most traumatic moment of their life. And if you think of that at the moment, like where your car got totaled and you're like, you're reacting like that. Well, yeah, it's kind of like that in their lives. The other side of that, that is just as beautiful when we come towards Christmas. Have you ever been around a child that experienced something that's like kind of cool, but they lose their mind with excitement? Like, this is the best thing ever. This summer we went down to California, and we went and we visited Santa Cruz. Santa Cruz, California, it's where my wife and I met. It's a very special place to us. And we went to the Santa Cruz Beach Boardwalk, which for all the memory and all the excitement is really just a sandy carnival. Like, that's all that it is. And it's the same kind of rides that they bring over to the Clackamas Town Center when they come in. It's really that. But we went on some of these rides with my two boys. Like, they might as well have flown to the moon. They were so excited. Like, they got on the rides and didn't stop screaming until we got off of the rides. Like, it's just sheer unbridled joy. Why? Because on the awesome things that have happened to them, this is like number one. It might even be the top two things in their lives. Kids have a lot of things, but one of the things that kids lack is experience and therefore perspective, right? If you're working with 1 year experience, you don't have a lot of perspective. I'm like, yeah, the ice cream cone thing dropped, but I overcame that challenge before. Nope, don't have that experience yet. This might undo the whole thing. This might be the end of me. And I think that's a really helpful starting point for us in talking about hope. Hope is the idea that our current reality is not going to be true forever. Our current space, the pain, the darkness of right now is not going to be there forever. And it doesn't mean that everything about this moment is darkness. But if you have pain in your life, if you have discomfort in your life, sometimes if you just have dullness in your life, we can at times become a bit like a child. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just that the current moment so dominates our life and experience. We're like, I don't know what the point in living anymore is. I hate my job. Because that moment so fills and pervades. And I was thinking that to God, the God who sees all eternity, all time, that at moments we might appear to God like a child who's dropped their ice cream cone, completely devoid of perspective. Like, I know it's bad, but this is really not all there is. I promise there's more. I promise there's a tomorrow. And so that's what we want to talk about. What does it look like to adopt God's perspective on our life? That this present moment is not forever, and it's actually not something that we just need to go through enough life experience. Or even though it can be helpful, to go talk to someone who's older than us, who's had more experience than us, and have them share with us. There's actually something incredibly significant in hope, and not just believing things will be better, but linking our hope to the God of eternity, the God who sees and holds all things, to say, this is not it. And so we start this morning in the book of Isaiah. If you brought your Bible, we're looking at Isaiah 9. And if you didn't, that's okay. We're going to have it up on the screen. We're going to look at Isaiah 9. And if you aren't familiar, Isaiah is a prophetic book, which means that a prophet is speaking these words. Someone who is talking on behalf of God, is sharing a vision on behalf of God. And if you've missed some of the big background, or just a refresher, how this book operates is that the chosen people of God, the Israelite nation, has taken the blessing, has taken the good things in life, and they've hoarded it. They've actually done some very not the chosen people of God things with being the chosen people of God. And the prophet is basically saying, I know there's a lot of trouble around you, and it's going to get worse because you haven't trusted God. You're going to be destroyed as a nation. You're going to lose your national identity, because other nations will come in and sweep in and take you out. Which, by the way, anytime you catch people taking like a verse out of books like maybe Jeremiah or Isaiah or some of these other prophetic books, and they're like, see, like this verse is like, it's my life verse, because it's like God is looking out for me. If you know the context, that usually comes on the tail end of like everything's destroyed. Like it's all bad news. But for the few of you that remain, the few of you that survive the reckoning, don't worry, it's going to get better. So sometimes we have to be careful how we just adopt these as our life verses, because it may not actually be about your life here in North America in the 21st century. So, verse 9:1, Isaiah 9:1. It says, nevertheless, that time of darkness and despair will not go on forever. Nevertheless, that time of darkness and despair will not go on forever. Isaiah just gets done talking about the reckoning, talking about there's consequences to your actions. When you've hoarded the blessing of God, when you have not served others, when you haven't looked out for the people that are outside of your circle of blessing, right? When you've closed the ranks of blessing and say, this is for us and nowhere else, there's a reckoning. But know that at the end of it, nevertheless, this time of darkness and despair will not go on forever. That kind of sums up hope, right? No matter how dark it gets, it's not everything. No matter how much despair there is, it's not forever. That there's something else to look forward to, that there's something on the other side. He continues in verse 9:2. Can we go to the next verse? Sorry. There we go. The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. For those who live in a land of deep darkness, a light will shine. I came across this week a quote from Desmond Tutu. If you know, Desmond Tutu is he was a bishop in South Africa. He was one that led the charge against the injustice of apartheid. Apartheid is that the white South Africans and the African South Africans were against each other. They were totally separate. And you had this power being wielded again. And Desmond Tutu is an African bishop. And he brought this line that says, "Hope is being able to see that there is light despite all the darkness." Hope is being able to see that there is a light despite all the darkness. And here's what I love, because this falls again into our perspective and being able to know. It doesn't say hope is knowing that there's going to be full light in a world of darkness. No, hope is being able to know that there is light. That darkness does not control the reality. The awareness that there is light too. The awareness that there is light coming. That is hope. That is being able to move in our next step. And this verse continues in Isaiah 9, 6, and 7. This is what it prophesies. This is what it talks about. "For a child is born to us, a son is given to us, the government will rest on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. His government and its peace will never end. He will rule with fairness and justice from the throne of his ancestor David for all eternity." So again, if we step into this time period of Isaiah, there is a king. There's a king of Israel. And how the king during this time is ruling is he's trying to decide which nation that's surrounding us that kind of threatens our safety do we align to. And it's this really difficult choice between the Assyrians and the Egyptians. They're surrounded on both sides with nations that are bigger and more powerful than them that can squash them in a second. And so the king, the leader, is really, it's outside of his control. It's outside of his power as to what to do. The hope, the promise is there will come a king. And in that king, we will find hope and dependence. We won't forever be dependent on another nation, on someone else. And you can see that if you were in this time, or if you knew the kind of recent history, you would assume that this help is coming through what? A military king, a military power. Basically, someone's going to come in that's going to invest enough in our defense budget that we're not going to have to worry anymore about the big bad nations, the big bad neighbors. And remember how we opened this in our time of prayer. We talked about the unexpected. What does it look like for this prophecy to be fulfilled by a champion of peace? What does it look like for this to be fulfilled by a king who actually doesn't rule over the nation, doesn't wear the crown, but in fact holds all the power? What does it look like to be ruled by a king that is the Prince of Peace? That sits on the throne forever and rules with justice. This is hope. Before we move on to the life of Jesus, I want you to sit and think, what would it have been like to be an Israelite? Knowing that within your nation, you do not have the ability to defend yourself alone. You need help. And might I add, it's an exercise where you really have to think outside of it, because as long as I've been alive, the U.S. has not been in that position. I've had the luxury, the great fortune of always living in this country, and I've never once thought, man, we have no power. We need someone to protect us. I sure hope the Canadians decide to protect us, right? I've never once had that thought. So to be in a place where you require the defense of someone else, that's a scary, scary proposition. And I don't want to undercut the threat and the worry and the concern that we have of a terrorist attack, of terrorism. But terrorism, by and large, are within the big picture, they're smaller incidences of terror, of attack. But it's not a more powerful nation moving in and wiping you out. What would that be like? What would that feel like? To be at the whim of a more powerful nation. That's a position and a place where hope means everything. It won't be like this forever. There is darkness now, but light is coming. And so to move now to the place of Jesus, how did Jesus demonstrate and live out hope? I encourage you to turn to Mark 5. Mark 5, and we're going to start kind of later in that chapter. We're going to look at Mark 5, 22. Here's the situation. We'll start in Mark 5, 22. There's a leader of a local synagogue whose name was Jairus. Arrived. When he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet, pleading fervently with him. "My little daughter is dying," he said. "Please come and lay your hands on her. Heal her so she can live." Now, there's some clues. If you read through the rest of the story, you can see what's happened. The life and ministry of Jesus is such that he is known as a healer, a miraculous healer. So basically, when you have exhausted the skills, the ability of the medical community, when you've exhausted the skills of everyone else, Jesus is the one you go to because he has the power to miraculously heal where everyone else has fallen short. So think of Jairus, who's a synagogue leader, to be able to share with people, to be able to be known in the community, to say, "Please help my daughter." That someone with a medical background would have probably already intervened, would have been called in. For Jairus, he would have been a man of some standing and some power. He would have been able to invest financially heavily in the health and well-being of his daughter, and yet she is still dying. Going out to Jesus is a last-ditch effort. This is the end of the line. It's Jesus or nothing. And what's really kind of special, what's unique about this, is Jesus doesn't represent the idea of hope. Jesus is the actual embodiment of hope. Outside of Jesus, there aren't any other answers. And I think it's fascinating for Jairus and for so many people, when you have a miracle worker, that's not usually the place you start, that's the place you finish. Do you know what I mean? You don't start going to the miracle worker and say, "Hey, can you heal?" It's like, let's try everything else. And then if we need help and healing, we go to Jesus. And so Jesus in the story agrees to go with Jairus. But because Jesus doesn't do what we think Jesus would do or should do, as Jesus is walking to Jairus, he has this whole encounter where he's walking and there's this crowd of people and they're all pushing around, and then Jesus stops. And everybody is kind of like, they're all fixated on Jesus, so everyone stops with him. It's like this horde of people moving as one. And Jesus says, "Wait, who touched me?" And you're like, "Are you kidding me? You're surrounded by people." Like, the better question is, who didn't touch you, right? We're all moving. We're all walking. There's a little bit of urgency. I don't know if you heard. She's dying right now. And Jesus has this whole encounter where he says, no, someone touched me. And a woman who had been bleeding for years, who had also exhausted all of her medical expenses. It actually says in the story that she spent everything she has. She's gone into significant debt to be able to find some medical way she can be healed, and has nothing and is still bleeding. And she touches the robe of Jesus as a last-ditch effort. And Jesus feels it and says, "Who touches me?" And they have this whole encounter where he talks to her. Now, what's beautiful about this story, if you don't know, that a woman who is bleeding, has been bleeding for this life, it's more than just a medical situation. For her, it's also a religious situation. You cannot have an open wound. You cannot be bleeding and be able to go into the synagogue. You can't make sacrifices. You can't be a part of the religious system, and you can't touch anyone. The very fact that she's in the crowd is a problem. She should not be there. She shouldn't have contact with other people. What Jesus does by stopping the crowd and recognizing her is he is reinstating her into the community. This woman who you've had to keep a lot of space around, this woman who has been unclean, she is clean again. She's reinstated. It is beautiful. When you read back in the story, it's this beautiful story. I'm sure in the moment to everyone except who? Jairus. We couldn't have done that later. Like, I know she has this problem, but she's had that problem for years. My daughter is dying now. Can we please go? Can we please hurry? This isn't a time for pit stops. This isn't a time for detours. And Jairus' worst case scenario happens. We read in verses 35 and 36. While he was still speaking to her, it's talking about Jesus to the woman. Messengers arrived from the home of Jairus, the leader of the synagogue. They told him, "Your daughter is dead. There's no use in troubling the teacher now." But Jesus overheard them and said to Jairus, "Don't be afraid. Just have faith." All right, come on. What the heck is that supposed to mean? Don't pretend like that's a cool thing to say in that scenario. Jesus already did his little healing thing, already had his little stop in the show to get there, and now the daughter has died. She's dead. Leave the guy alone. It's too late. And Jesus has the nerve to say, "Don't be afraid, just have faith." Come on, Jesus, this is the wrong time for Christian bumper stickers, right? We don't need that theology lesson now. This is the time for mourning. This is the time for grief. But the story continues, verse 37 through 39. Then Jesus stopped the crowd and wouldn't let anyone go with him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the home of the synagogue leader, Jesus saw much commotion and weeping and wailing. He went inside and asked, "Why all this commotion and weeping? The child isn't dead. She's only asleep." Not a good start. Continuing in verse 40. Oh, we don't have that? That's cool. I do have my Bible here. It's just too low for me to read, and I'm losing my eyesight. There's no dignified way to do this, so I'm so sorry. All right. But they laughed at him. She's not dead but asleep, but they laughed at him. Which, by the way, you have to think that when you're there mourning the death of a young woman, you have to say something pretty ridiculous for people to laugh in that situation. Like, come on, Jesus. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were there with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately the girl stood up and walked around. She was 12 years old. At this, they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this and told them to give her something to eat. I love that last line. "Hey, everybody, death takes it out of you. Can we get her a snack ASAP, right? She's got to be famished, all that dying she's been doing." This is why I bring up that story. Remember how we talked about kids, like a kid who is on a roller coaster ride or a kid who has dropped their ice cream. It is the best and the worst life has to offer, because it really is the best and the worst. They're pretty awful and pretty great things, but it's really just more a lack of perspective. When you come into this kind of situation, this betrays any sense of perspective, right? It's not like Jairus didn't just hang around with someone who had lived long enough and like, no, I've seen little girls resurrected from the dead before. You know, there's still hope here. No, there was a situation where the eternal outlook of God, that only the perspective of God, only the perspective of the miraculous had anything to say in this situation. When Jesus says, don't be afraid, just have faith to entertain hope, that hope is only possible because of the presence of God, the very presence of God. When we talk about the Christmas season and what we wait for, what we see in the presence of Jesus Christ, what we see in the birth of an infant, when we talk about hope, it's how do I take my world, how do I take my understanding of the world, and I don't just trust my own perspective, but instead I look to God's perspective. Now, in this miraculous situation, is it good for us to go to our friends who have just lost a loved one and said, I don't know, I read a story. It might not be time to start mourning yet. It might not be the most helpful thing. In fact, I'll say it isn't the most helpful thing. But in our life, in our situations where we feel like we have hit a roadblock, where we have run out of options, instead of declaring the death of our hopes and dreams, instead of marking the time and the date and the hour, instead of putting the tag on the toe of all the things that we hoped would happen, what if instead we found ourselves beside a manger? Beside the birth of Jesus Christ, this infant Jesus Christ who brought with him surpassing hope in the face of hopelessness, in the face of no chance, in the place of no return. And we brought to Christ not gift of gold, frankincense, and myrrh, but we brought our doubts, we brought our questions, and we say, God, is this a place where your hope still applies? God, are you still wanting to resurrect this? God, are you still bringing this back? God, how are you going to move in this circumstance, in this situation? When it feels like our work situation is dead and gone, like I can't work another day with these people or at this company. When it feels like our home situation is done, I can't spend another moment with my mother or father. I can't spend another moment with my spouse. When it feels like our friendship is dead and gone, what does it look like to go to the God of surpassing hope and to say, is there a light in this darkness, Lord? Would you illuminate your way? Would you illuminate your path? I'm not saying it's all going to turn up roses. I'm not saying that every situation finds resurrection. Not every death ends in resurrection. But instead of making that call ourselves, what if we put that aside and we let the God of hope, the God who brings light into the darkness, make that call and guide and lead us? I'm going to invite Nathan up. He's going to lead us in a song. But let's go to a time of prayer. I would imagine that we're all a bit like Jairus. We're all a bit like the synagogue leader. We have situations in our life that feel like they're dying or dead. And in our prayer time, what if we were to offer those up to God and see what Jesus has? Let's pray.